Everybody, welcome to We've Got Issues. I am Cliff Schechter, sadly not your normal host, but Joshua Holland and Liz Prezza are off this week. So you're kind of stuck with me. They asked me to fill in. I'm here. We're going to talk about politics. We're going to talk about the elections. Got a couple great guests for you guys that will talk about what we've seen in Georgia and what we will see in Georgia coming up in the special elections for the Senate on January 5th. And we'll also talk about instances of voter suppression. Sadly, will not surprise you that another reporter witnessed in North Carolina. And there's been follow-up on that, including lawsuits filed by the NAACP and others in federal court. So we'll get to that. But why don't we start first with Georgia? It's on everybody's mind. We've got not only did Joe Biden win Georgia for the first time since 1992 when Bill Clinton won as a Democrat, but it was a close election, and neither Senate election was decided, as the races, no one got above 50% of the vote. So we've got more fun, a special election coming up on January 5th. And I am lucky enough to have with me here Kim Lawson to talk to you about that. Kim Lawson is a senior editor for The Courier, who covers politics, I think, nationally too, but in Georgia. You're based in Georgia, aren't you, Kim?
Yeah, I am. I'm right outside of Augusta.
Right outside of Augusta. And Kim just wrote a really interesting piece on what suburban voters are thinking in Georgia, and considering that was a huge constituency that moved away from the Republican Party to Joe Biden and could be crucial in the upcoming Senate elections, I thought we'd start talking about that. So how about it, Kim? What'd you see? What'd you hear? What do you got for us?
Yeah, so, you know, first, we were really interested in doing this story for a few different reasons. One is, you know, like you mentioned, I live in Georgia, born and raised here. And when the state went blue, it was just amazing. Even though we saw, you know, how close Stacey Abrams was in the governor's race a couple of years ago, you know, I really wanted to get a better handle of how my fellow Georgians, what they were thinking about when they went to the polls. And so I reached out to a few different people, connections through connections, and really wanted to get a handle on, you know, people who live outside of Atlanta, because that area was such a huge deal for Biden. So, you know, obviously, you know, as so many Americans are thinking about, coronavirus was a big deal.
I saw Georgia. That in the article you wrote, where it seemed like a number of folks were talking about that. Right?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, we're seeing right now in Georgia, there's been nearly 9,000 Georgians have passed from the virus. And so just watching how the Trump administration has handled the response was really disappointing for the people that I talked to.
And did those people think that, I mean, was it sort of purely a vote against Trump, or did they think that Joe Biden presented them an opportunity to handle the virus in a much more, let's call it, I don't care. I'm not being objective here, in a professional way, in a way where scientists were not people to be shunned, but listened to.
Yeah. I think it was a little bit of both. I think that for one thing, the congressional response or lack of response from the Senate since March in terms of COVID relief was a big deal. Some of the people that I talked to, they really thought that Biden would be able to reach across the aisle and, you know, help start the conversation or move this conversation along in terms of advancing some relief for Americans who need it the most. But also, you know, seeing Trump not listen to science, not listen to scientists, and not elevate these experts, was it really bothered a lot of them.
Yep. And were these folks who had identified, do you know any of them, if any of them identified as Republican before or independent? Was this the kind of issue that brought them across party lines?
You know, I didn't really get into that. I really wanted to focus on this moment right now. We didn't really get into that.
Getting into that. Okay. Obviously, reading your piece, which, by the way, everyone, is a really interesting piece. It's at couriernewsroom.com. If you look under Kimberly Lawson, you'll find it. Also, it's got a little sort of Georgia title to it here, and it's called Want to Know What Suburban Voters Really Think? We spoke to Georgians to find out. So we're talking about that. We're talking about the pandemic, which it seemed like it really, and again, as somebody myself living in a urban suburban area with kids, reading what you had to say here, it really seemed like people, you know, who had to see their kids either go to school virtually or go to school in what I call a plexiglass prison. My kids are in that right now, and it scares me every day, quite frankly. You made some great points about that, but you also brought up about, you know, criminal justice reform and the Black Lives Matter movement. And there's obviously no doubt that Donald Trump and the Republican Party tried to make that an issue to win back suburban voters. I mean, you know, he barely even hid the sort of the racism and they're coming for you to the suburbs and the suburbs will be destroyed by Joe Biden. He made it sound like Biden would be sort of maybe driving a tank in himself to blow up the suburbs. Did you find in your piece and in your research that in speaking to people that had any effect in either direction on the race?
Oh yeah, definitely. I spoke to one gentleman who lives in Stone Mountain. He's an African-American man, and he talked about how, you know, racism is in his backyard. Stone Mountain is home to like one of the biggest Confederate monuments. And he said that, you know, after seeing the protests this year and then also just seeing, you know, the lived experience of Black men and, you know, dealing with police brutality, you know, regularly, like he really realized that, or he really believes that in order for change to happen, it has to come from the top down. And Joe Biden, Kamala Harris both talked about that.
Correct. Yeah. And I found that I was going to bring that up to you when I saw that you'd written about Stone Mountain. Not everybody may know this, but not only is it a Confederate monument, but it's where the modern Ku Klux Klan was founded after, you know, you'd had the Klan in a period during Reconstruction, sadly, after the Civil War, and then they ended up helping end Reconstruction. And then when it was reconstituted, I'm trying to think of the year it would have, when that was, but in any case, I think early 20th century, it was at Stone Mountain. That's a pretty infamous place. So you found that those two issues certainly played a role. Did you find any other issues that jumped out at you that were important to the folks you talked to?
Yeah, I think the other thing that came up in my conversations was empathy, like just having someone in charge who could empathize with the struggle that Americans are dealing with right now. I think that that's just been a big part that's been missing in so many of these conversations when it comes to the protests, to coronavirus, all of that, just having someone who cared. I think one woman said, you know, she like recognized the life that Biden has lived and thought that because of his lived experience, he could be someone who would be more understanding about all the things that we're going through.
So all the hours Donald Trump clocked in on the golf course, you're saying that didn't make people think he was paying particularly close attention to all of this?
No, not so much.
I'm sorry, I can't help myself. Really interesting, and obviously as I think probably the listeners, most listeners here know, and you know, I stated at the beginning, Georgia has not finished potentially delivering yet to Democrats. In sort of an incredible moment, both Senate races. So the way Georgia works is if in Senate races you don't get over 50%, you go to a runoff. And in both races, there was a special election because a Republican senator, about, I don't remember exactly when, Johnny Isaacson, about 6 months ago, had to step down, and there was Kelly Loeffler was appointed by Donald Trump in place in his stead there. So that you had these two elections, and the fact that neither of them did the Republican get 50% means that like it's almost like this crazy free-for-all where we've got, you know, two Senate seats, hugely important, a recently turned blue state, as you said. This is the first time the state went blue in a presidential election since 92, and we're talking almost 30 years. And then on top of that, it actually will decide who controls the U.S. Senate, which is insane. So you pretty much have everything going on here. What are you hearing in terms of the Senate race? Are you hearing anything in either direction of whether Democrats or Republicans might have an advantage or one of the candidates over the others? Or I don't know. Let me throw that to you and see what you do.
Yeah. So the folks that I talk to, I think they all recognize that if we want to see any movement on coronavirus relief, any, you know, substantial criminal justice reform, the Democrats have to be able to move forward And the Senate is just so vital to that. In order for Biden's policy agenda to make any movement, David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, they have to be voted out, and we have to get Democrats in their place.
All right. And not surprising. Is this something you're hearing around in general, or did this come from some of the folks you spoke to about the presidential race?
Yeah. That's from some of the people that I spoke to about the presidential race.
Which, again, makes this even more important because we're now talking about the ever important suburbs.
Right.
And that will probably be suburban turnout and who votes there and how they vote. Obviously, I think we'll probably end up deciding this thing. I mean, again, Biden won, but after a recount, and I think Trump is calling for another one. Trump likes to lose states multiple times before he gives in. So he likes these recounts, and he's calling for another one. But in the first one, I think the final margin was 12,760 votes, which is incredible if you think about it. So these races will be close. Do you have any, you don't have to do this, by the way, do you have any predictions to make as to who you think might win from what you're seeing and hearing?
Oh, I'm too afraid to say anything out loud, honestly.
That I get. Hey, let me ask you this too. This is, I don't know if you've written about this or not in other pieces, but you know, there was a lot of coverage when Kelly Loeffler, you know, when it came out that she had traded a number of stocks. Her husband's company owns the New York Stock Exchange. For folks who don't know that, she's the wealthiest U.S. senator, worth about $500 million. It came out that she had traded numerous stocks, gotten rid of those that would be hurt by the pandemic, and bought those that might be helped. So, you know, delivery companies, you know, an Amazon or what, you like those, and Uber Eats or whatever, you know, you don't like anymore. Any sort of those kinds of companies that would have to do with public gatherings, with transportation. So that came out way back when, and that's hurt her along the way. What's been more interesting to me is that we've had similar now stories, multiple national stories on David Perdue. Mm-hmm. One that in fact just came out today that I saw, and let's see, you know, if I can actually find it, because I probably should have had it open in front of me, but that would be giving me way too much credit as way too prepared and way too smart. There we go. So the AP just came out with a story 5 hours ago. When the COVID-19 pandemic began, Georgia Republican Senator David Perdue sold up to $5 million worth of stock in a company where he once served on the board. Weeks later, after shares nosedived, he bought much of it back, and it quadrupled in value since. Mm-hmm. I know his opponent, John Ossoff, is calling for a ban on all members of Congress trading stock. I think that a lot of us out in the public would support that. These guys have access to all sorts of inside information, and they've had very few rules determining what they can trade and what information they can use to trade and not trade. They can make windfalls on this kind of stuff. Two questions. One, have the stories about Perdue, these stories, because this is like the third one I've seen nationally in the last week. Have these stories on Perdue come out? And if you've seen them a lot around Georgia, or maybe in the advertising of Ossoff or other forces, that's one. And two, do you think that that issue will make a difference?
You know, honestly, I think these stories show like this disconnect between, you know, Georgians on the ground who are like trying to make ends meet and the lawmakers who don't have to worry about whether or not they can afford healthcare or, you know, whether or not they should go to urgent care to take care of an issue or not. You know, I have friends in the suburbs. I have, I have, like I said, I was born and raised here. Like my dad is not asking me about Perdue's stock options or decisions that he's made. He is asking me about, you know, taking him to the doctor in a couple of weeks for a procedure. So, right. You know, I want to believe that, you know, people will get mad about these things, but at the same time, I think we're all just trying to survive this moment. And I think that if more people were able to see this disconnect, like that might move the needle some in terms of electing people who actually represent our interests. But, you know, like I haven't really heard many people that I live around talk about these things.
Okay. That's a fair answer. I think some of that will depend on, I can say this as somebody who works in the realm of strategy on things for Democrats here and there, will probably how they message this, if they are able to smartly say, you know, while they were ignoring the pandemic and not telling you about it and not telling you how dangerous it was, they were also trading stocks to benefit themselves. I think sort of a multi-layered campaign probably has something to do with that. And maybe the fact that Purdue and Loeffler have tried to get rid of the Affordable Care Act and, of course, pre-existing conditions. You know, this will probably be the biggest pre-existing condition, or one of them, not the biggest necessarily, but one of them coming out of this, people who've survived COVID. Is there anything else you'd like to add? That all is really informative and helpful, Kim, and we really appreciate it. You're helping us sort of get to the heart of what's going on in Georgia, especially with the past election, but especially with such a big one, double election coming up. Is there anything else that you can think of that would be good for folks to know?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. You know, early voting starts pretty soon in Georgia. Can't wait to get out there and cast my ballot.
So that's, I guess, folks listening in Georgia know that too. You know, make sure you know you're registered. We want to make sure everybody can vote who can. That includes, by the way, those that are, I believe, that are turning 18 that were 17 for the last election, I believe, that you're able to vote too. So look up what the rules are, get yourself registered, and make a plan to get to the either, you know, however you can vote, whether it's going to the local polls or it's sending out a ballot in the mail or however you do it. Let's get out there and let's repeat what we just saw, which was the highest voter participation level in 100, I think, maybe it might have been over. It was almost 100 years, over 100 years, something like that, which is incredible. Two-thirds, I believe, of folks voted, maybe towards 70%. I think that's probably all we have here, Kim. Let's let folks know how to find you. They can go to, if I'm correct, careernewsroom.com would be where they can find your articles. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And I'm also on Twitter. It's KimLawson22.
Okay, so at KimLawson22, go to careernewsroom.com. Kim, thanks so much for giving us your time, particularly the day before Thanksgiving. Have a happy and healthy Thanksgiving. And thank you for being here.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. Welcome back to We've Got Issues, folks. This is Cliff Schechter. I am, as you may know, not your normal host, but I am a guest host for today, sitting in for Joshua Holland, who's kind enough to ask me to be here. We just spoke with Kim Lawson. That was a really interesting interview. What to expect in Georgia, upcoming elections, what we saw in the past election, and now we've got another key swing state, probably, I believe, the state the Democrats came the closest in but lost 1.4%, I believe, which is the state of North Carolina. Obviously, a lot of the issues were the same, and we talked about Black Lives Matter with Kim Lawson. We're now lucky enough to have with us Sarah Ovaska, who is a reporter with, let me get the title right, Sarah, Associate Editor and Reporter with Cardinal and Pine, which is based in North Carolina. Sarah actually witnessed an act of racism, of voter suppression, kind of thing we all know that happens and maybe is even responsible for some of these poll numbers here and there not being as far apart as we'd hoped they would be or in the negative. It's a terrible legacy our country has endured of racism and voter suppression, something we want to end. And therefore, I'm really happy that Sarah's here because she broke a story as it was happening on Election Day. Thanks so much for being here, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Cliff. And yes, unfortunately, here in North Carolina, we too have seen a lot of acts of voter suppression that are continuing to this day.
Yeah, I mean, I saw your thread on Twitter as it was taking place. I've read your articles. Why don't I just throw it to you to tell people what you saw that day and you know, where we are now with what occurred.
Great. And so if I could just back up a few days before Election Day, this occurred in a part of the state that's located between Greensboro and Raleigh. If you're familiar with our state, it was in a county called Alamance County that has had a really tangled and difficult history with race and racism. There is a sitting sheriff, an elected sheriff there, who was actually brought up on basically on civil rights charges during the Obama administration, pretty much the second sheriff that we had in the country to face these type of accusations for his treatment of Latino residents in his county. Anyway, so a few days before Election Day, there has been a lot of Black Lives Matter protests and rallies and movements across the state. And here in Alamance County, there was a lot of action around a Confederate statue that's outside the courthouse in this county, in Alamance County. And at this county, there would be protests and marches that would come up, but there was also a very sizable pro-Confederate contingent who would also show up, flying the Dixie flag, things like that.
Wonderful.
A lot of vileness, to say the least, a lot of racial epithets being screamed. And the feeling was on behalf of both the local chapter of the NAACP and Black Lives Matters and other groups that were organizing around this, asking for this Confederate statue to be taken down, was that the local authorities were pretty tolerant and pretty kind of aligned with these Confederate supporters. So there was a get out the vote rally on behalf of these Black Lives Matter protesters. And this is something that we have, I don't know if it happens a lot in other parts of the state, but we call it souls to the polls. It's really pretty prevalent during the early voting season, I should say, especially in Black communities. A lot of Black churches get together, and it's just a really joyous and it's a wonderful that's all like get to the polls together and vote together. And so this was kind of done in this vein. And there was a Reverend Greg Drumright, who was leading this charge. And during this march to the polls, they stopped in front of the Confederate statue and took a knee to recognize George Floyd. And police, right after that stop, right after that happened, whipped out the pepper spray and started pepper spraying a crowd that involved elderly people, folks that
were taking a knee.
It was right after they got off. So right after, and then they, you know, because the feeling on the police was that it was time to get up and move. Don't be in the
street. So it's a crime somehow that you're marching to the polls and you
chose
to stop for a second.
That would be, certainly not my opinion, but, and so that there were two different periods during this rally where the police, sprayed pepper spray. I was there. I got pepper sprayed, as well as basically anyone. And I've covered criminal justice and police matters for a very long time, going on 15 years. And I have never really seen the type of aggression I saw that day, and just the kind of lack of respect for people that the law enforcement was exhibiting.
Yeah, I mean, I think what was really, you know, I'm trying to think of the right word, but sort of touched you in a way, one, about what we were seeing. And I mean, you know, this, we'd seen these kinds of protests, and we'd seen the reaction from so many police. And again, this isn't to condemn all police, it's to say, sadly, there are a lot of places like Alamance, it seems, where the sheriffs seem to have more in common with the guys who like the Confederate statues than the majority of folks. And, you know, we'd seen all of that. But the fact that this happened, you know, ahead of the election and then happened on Election Day, like around our elections, I don't know, that just adds something even more sinister to it in a way. I mean, now they were combining their, you know, all these things, right? The racism and opposition to equality, and now we're throwing in voter suppression too.
Yeah, it does. It was pretty galling and pretty shocking to witness. And a lot of people, so this was during the early voting period, and a fair bit of people had planned on walking another block and casting their ballots and, you know, with pepper spray in your lungs. And it was quite scary. It was a very tense situation. And honestly, you know, we're the South, people walk around with weapons a lot. I mean, it really is I think, a miracle that we didn't see anything more serious happen. Because right. There was such, from what my observations were from the law enforcement, it was a very quick to escalate as opposed to de-escalate. And I could see how quickly that someone might feel the justification to use even more force against these peaceful marchers. I mean, it was a peaceful, it was a joyous occasion. It was a chance for parents to take their kids and show them, hey, this is what we do as a community. We vote, we exercise our rights. I had one woman tell me, you know, I'm here for my ancestors because of what my ancestors went through. And here we are fighting the same fight. So I won't say that actions like this are widespread across the state. Thankfully, on election day itself, we did not have a lot of reports, but I think that there certainly are parts of our state, and I imagine
the country, right? It's not even just about, I mean, that's why I thought this was so important, is I'm not sure if this happened elsewhere in North Carolina. What I am sure of is over the years we've witnessed this. You know, I live in the Cincinnati, Ohio, and there are parts not that far from me here. You know, you go a county or two away, and you had one of the more infamous viral videos from one of these protests in a place called Claremont County. You know, I think it's probably 30, 40 minutes from here, of the local law enforcement standing there watching as people who were marching, a few of them in a Black Lives Matter march, were assaulted by people in the area, and it went super viral. So we know these things are happening all over the country. And that, and you just sort of were there at the, you know, at this, I was going to say the right moment, maybe the wrong moment, but you were able to chronicle this as a good reporter for us, so the rest of us could know what the hell was going on there. What are we looking at since then? Because I think if I've read your more recent piece on this, it looks like that we're now looking at this ending up, this has ended up in federal court, and the NAACP and others are involved.
Right. So we've got a lot of things happening. We've got there's two of the country's premier civil rights organizations, legal organizations. One, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, that's headed by Sherilyn Ifill, which your listeners may, you know, that may ring a bell for them. Yep. They are representing some of the protesters, marchers, I think is the word that's more appropriate
we should, how we talk matters. And I think I said protesters too, and I shouldn't have said that either. These were peaceful marchers. So thank you.
Yes. Peaceful marchers. And so they filed a suit in federal court under what's basically known as the Ku Klux Klan Act. And this was an act that was passed basically to allow a federal path to address some of the voter intimidation efforts we saw during Jim Crow, the civil rights era. And here we are, it's 2020, and that we now, again, have some civil rights organizations using this law in order to seek some justice and seek some help for these marchers. And we also have, in addition to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, which is actually a separate organization than the NAACP, it's split off.
Interesting. Maybe, I didn't even know
that. Maybe Thurgood Marshall years. I'm not quite sure. I'm sure some of your listeners probably know the history, just to be able to operate on their own. There's another group called the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, and they are also participating, and they are representing a separate but related group, also filing similar accusations in the federal court. Some of those lawyers are actually based here in North Carolina, and they've been doing this of civil rights work for years and just really well known in the legal community, the justice community. So we've got those federal lawsuits going on. And shockingly, we've also kind of had the law enforcement double down in their efforts and kind of resistance. We saw the charges of so 23 people were arrested at that march. Largely on misdemeanors, were released. And so then we've since seen the de facto leader, Reverend Drumright, who has been, his group, Justice for the Next Generation, has been really outspoken about Black Lives Matter and just the need for criminal justice reform. He had his charges trumped up to felony charges. So now he's facing felony charges of assault on an officer.
Jeez.
And if there is video out there, if my Twitter handle's at Sarah Ovaska, I've had some on it. And if people want that, there's ways to see this protest, and it's hard to see where that would be a felony charge. I mean, I suppose we're going to have a judge and jury decide that. Right. We've also had a few of these marchers went to a county commission meeting to exercise their rights as citizens of this county and speak during the public comment period to voice their dissatisfaction and how they were upset about the police presence. And the county commission, which is, I would say, some allies of the sheriff, it's a fairly conservative Republican county overall, they shut down the meeting, and then the sheriff's office arrested three people. And it's unclear on what basis. They're claiming that it was the folks were being disruptive, but the accounts from people that were there are saying, no, we were just leaving. It's kind of this, and there's these little developments, but basically it just seems to be this escalating situation where we're seeing kind of some of this old guard trying to hold on. This is the way it's always done. We've had our Confederate statues up and continue that. And we've got some really pretty inspirational organizing. We're seeing Black, brown, white allies, the people in this county, very grassroots, that are getting together and pushing for progress and for change in their community.
Well, obviously, that's hugely important. As we know, it was the grassroots effort during the, you know, many of the Black Lives Matter protests that led to, I mean, a huge change in perception, mainstream acceptance, to the point where you were seeing folks take a knee. I mean, you could watch a European soccer game and they would start, the teams would take a knee. It was incredible. I think it led to a lot of change in perception in the suburbs, other areas. So that's really important. Obviously, what we do on the legal and political level is really important too. So I've got a question for you. You know, unlike a lot of these other southern states, and, you know, again, North Carolina, it's more New South. It certainly has changed in who's moved there. And I mean, again, it was a 1.4% margin, but, you know, that Biden lost by. But even more than that, you know, North Carolina successfully elected Governor Roy Cooper in 2016. And I believe the Attorney General too, Josh Stein, is a Democrat. Am I correct?
Yes. He's a Democrat as well.
So is there anything that, and I think you wrote about this, so this might be a good chance to ask you and have you segue to the piece you wrote on this. Is there anything that either the Attorney General Josh Stein or the Governor Roy Cooper, both of whom were also reelected in this election, can do? I think they were. Well, I know Cooper was reelected, right? So Stein, I didn't follow, but was he? Did he have a reelection this time?
Yes, he was. He was reelected as well. A little bit of a closer race, but he pulled ahead.
Okay, so in both those cases, you know, again, a lot of some further deeper southern states lack this kind of accountability because they have right wingers in these offices who just don't care, or more than that, are helping the wrong side. Quite frankly, here you've got. Good people. So are they, you know, is there anything the Attorney General can do to be helpful in dismissing these charges and overturning them? Is there anything the governor, I would think, has some pardon power? And again, I know you wrote something about this, so I'll kick it to you.
Yeah, so I think there are a number of things that either could do. We haven't seen that action, any actions happen yet. I think our Attorney General is the top prosecutor. If there's an ability to pass, to have his office handle them, these charges, they can decide what to do. But they would need to go through the legal system and try to see if those charges could be given to them or essentially transferred over. But the Attorney General's office is also, I mean, they kind of, you know, oversee police and criminal justice standards, and they certainly, the State Bureau of Investigation, which is kind of like our North Carolina version of the FBI, if you will, they are the ones who are always called in for after police shootings to investigate the circumstances with police involved shootings, things like that. And so it's while it's been seen as a bit of a rubber stamping process in the past, I think there's certainly the structure there that if there was a genuine interest in kind of confronting what's been going on in this county and the use of force, that there is a path forward. I think there also are things that the governor could do. I'm just even speaking out about it more or dedicating resources or addressing it. But we've not really seen, we've had our governor say that this was inappropriate, but we've not seen any kind of concrete action from either office yet.
Okay. And I saw in your piece that Governor Cooper, you know, during his first term had not pardoned anyone. And that's not necessarily, you know, obviously everything depends on context, right? If you're pardoning, we're hearing about Donald Trump pardoning Mike Flynn, that would be a bad use of the pardon power. But in this case, where we're talking about, you know, the felony charges against peaceful marchers, as well as misdemeanor charges, which could, you know, lead to loss of jobs, loss of income, and all sorts of other difficulties. What, you know, do we have the opportunity perhaps where he might jump in and issue some pardons?
I think he theoretically could, but I doubt we'll see it from this governor, from Roy Cooper. He was, just to give a little background, he himself was in the Attorney General's seat for many years. He was elected first, I think, in 2000. And so he was the top prosecutor in the state for 15 years. And he is facing some criticism from progressive groups and criminal justice groups for his lack of action when it comes to pardons and clemency. And you're right in that he has not issued a single pardon during his first term. And that makes him stand out. The records that we have in our state go back 40 years, and there has never been a governor in at least those 40 years that has not issued a pardon, whether it's a Republican governor or a Democrat governor. We tend to, we like to switch back and forth here in North Carolina.
Yeah,
We are very much a swing state. You know, we like to say, you know, at one point we had Jesse Helms and John Edwards representing us in the U.S. Senate. They're not exactly like dinner party buddies, right? Like, and we're not. Yep. So we're a state that is not really fully Democrat, fully Republican, but what we've had is that the governors have been willing to exercise these powers they have of clemency and pardons, and we've not seen Governor Cooper do that. And that's significant. Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's significant because we have this little thing called the global pandemic right now, and our state prisons are incredibly, the inmates and others are very susceptible for contracting this disease. And so there's been a lot of groups, whether it's the ACLU or some the NAACP in our state, other groups really calling on the governor to use his clemency powers to let those inmates who have served sometimes decades of time, rehabilitated, no infractions on their records, you know, folks who really are ready to be let out, to let them out in light of this pandemic. And we've just not seen the governor do that.
Well, I have to say, as somebody who has been very, you know, I sit on the board of the Ohio Innocence Project here, and I've, you know, been passionate about these issues for a while. So yes, I'm a good Democrat, and certainly will always think the Democrat is, almost always, at least it seems the Democrat is superior. But if that is where Governor Cooper is, even though I like a lot of his other policies, and I think this would tell me that maybe, folks, there's a grassroots campaign out there for you in North Carolina to put a little pressure on the governor and make sure that he hears from you and knows that you don't expect that innocent folks who are doing nothing should have their lives ruined because of, let's call it, an overactive group of racist sheriffs.
Go
ahead.
I was going to say, we kind of a side issue to all of this is that we've got some people who have been released from prison because they were wrongfully convicted. It's not a question mark. We've had federal courts say they've not they were wrongly prosecuted of these crimes. They spent years in prison. One man, Ronnie Long, spent 44 years in prison. He was let out in August on a crime that he was a rape charge that he was wrongfully committed on, and he's waiting on his pardon from Cooper. And his lawyer, there's a very active Innocence Project out of Duke University, Duke Law School. Mm-hmm. His lawyer has said, you know, the governor is convene these task forces on racial justice well, where is Ronnie Long's justice? He was convicted in a racially charged, Ronnie Long is black in a racially charged mm-hmm. atmosphere, all white jury, white judge, white prosecutor, white victim. Where is his racial justice? And the governor, quite honestly, has been silent about Mr. Long's case, as well as there's three other men who are waiting, who have been declared innocent, that are waiting for pardons from the governor, and they've not been issued. And that has significance because it's not only an act of the state of North Carolina essentially saying, we're sorry, we messed up. We took these years of your life away from you. The state legislature has also opted to set aside money for these people to make up for these lost years. Yep. And they can't get it without a pardon. So Ronnie Long, I've spoken with him. He's living off donations, donated groceries, donated goods.
Well, that's ridiculous. And so now I'm even more fired up that people need to get out there and have a talk with the governor. We've been through it in this state. We had a man, Ricky Jackson, released after 39 years for a crime he didn't commit. And again, African-American cops who forced a witness to say something they didn't want to say through threat of violence. And numerous other cases where I think we're now over 1,000 years easy of time served with folks we've gotten released who, you know, so the point is it's not just North Carolina or Ohio, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. Folks need to have the scales fall from their eyes. Our justice system has not worked the way we meant it to work. And we need to rectify as many of those situations and help people as best we can. So I think we are running out of time, but I wanted to ask you before I let you go, Sarah, and thank you again for joining us on the day before Thanksgiving, giving us your time. Is there anything else you'd like to share with folks, from your recent writings in North Carolina or anything you've seen there you think would kind of worth mentioning? How about that?
Right. Well, I encourage people. We're at www.cardinalpine.com. I'm on Twitter quite often at Sarah Ovaska.
She's a great follower, by the way, everybody. Follow her.
Yes, I should pry my fingers away from my phone at times, but I do not. We've got a lot going on here. I think, like probably every state in our nation, there's a lot of complexities to our state. And so we're out there trying to be able to give a closer look at the issues that are affecting people, whether it's criminal justice, racial justice, economic justice. There's a lot of problems in need of being fixed.
Well, there you go, guys. So you should go to Cardinal and Pine, and you should read about this, particularly if you're anywhere in the area of North Carolina, but really nationally. It's a great publication. Sarah's a great writer. You should find her at Sarah Ovaska on Twitter and go and see what she has to say. And I think that will finish us off, guys. I've been had the honor of sitting in for the great Joshua Hollander this week. For We Have Issues here. I want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving. A happy virtual Thanksgiving. It's not too late to change if you're planning on traveling and getting together in big groups. Do not. We've got a pandemic to beat. Otherwise, seriously, everybody have a great Thanksgiving, and you'll have Joshua back next week. Take care. We'll be right back.
was until the moment was right. I just been hiding you away from the light, waiting for somebody to kiss me alive.